Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. My name is Fred Flight, Senior Vice President with the Center for Security Policy, and I'm substituting for your usual host, Frank Gaffney. I have three extraordinary guests today, but first I wanted to talk to you about the North Korea situation, specifically a resolution passed last Saturday that puts significant financial sanctions on North Korea in response to its tests in July of two missiles that appear to be ICBMs that may be able to strike the entire continental United States. These were the toughest sanctions ever imposed on North Korea. They reportedly will cut a third of North Korea's export earnings, about $1 billion. But frankly, regardless of how strong they are, and strong sanctions by the UN have been imposed before, they're not going to succeed unless China cooperates. And this is a big problem. There were some pretty tough sanctions passed against North Korea last November in response to missile and nuclear tests that took place last fall. These sanctions put a cap on North Korean exports of coal and iron ore and should have had a significant effect on the North Korean economy. But what happened? In the first quarter of 2017, North Korea's trade with China increased by 37% over the same quarter in 2016, and iron ore exports increased by 250%. This is where North Korea is getting the money it is using to construct nuclear weapons and missiles. North Korea tested 17 missiles in 2017. Kim Jong-un has tested about 84 missiles since he became North Korea's leader in late 2011. That's versus about 31 tests for his father and grandfather combined. China is funding these WMD programs. Now, I think it's significant that China agreed to step up the sanctions after these two ICBM tests, but I think we should make no mistake, a significant factor for China's change in policy is President Donald Trump, who has made it clear that unlike Barack Obama, he's not going to kick this crisis down the road to the next president. And I think the U.S. is starting to make inroads with the Chinese to recognize that North Korea's missile and nuclear programs are on a very dangerous trajectory. Eventually, they will become so advanced that there could be an accident, maybe a missile landing on a neighboring state, or maybe North Korea will decide that it can use these weapons to blackmail regional states or the United States to get something that it wants. Unfortunately, this problem has been allowed to fester far too long and is really posing a huge threat. Now, North Korea is preparing ICBMs, solid-fueled missiles that can be easily hidden and launched in as little as 20 minutes, and has a substantial arsenal, we believe, of nuclear weapons. So how many nuclear weapons does North Korea have? Well, North Korea's nuclear weapons program is what Donald Rumsfeld would call a known unknown. We just know they have a nuclear weapons program because after some of the nuclear tests, there has been air sampling indicating radioactive gases that indicate that a nuclear device had been detonated. But the actual size of the device, whether it has been miniaturized, whether it was fueled by uranium or plutonium, whether it was an advanced fission device, whether it was a hydrogen bomb, which is extremely unlikely, I might add, nobody outside of North Korea knows. I have to wonder whether the Iranians know, because I think they're collaborating with the North Koreans, but that's another issue. So how many weapons do the North Koreans have? Here are five estimates I'm going to read for you just to give you an idea. The left-wing Plowshares Fund, which is funded by George Soros, believes that North Korea could have under 15 weapons. This is as of July 2017. The left-wing Federation for American Scientists believe that North Korea should could have 10 to 20 nuclear weapons. This is also as of July 2017. Siegfried Hecker, a former head of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, said in 2016 North Korea could have up to 20 nuclear weapons. David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, said in an April 2017 report, North Korea could have 13 to 30 weapons and up to 50 nuclear weapons in 2020. And finally, according to a 2015 Wall Street Journal report, China's top nuclear experts believe that North Korea had 20 nuclear weapons in 2015 and could have had as many as 40 in 2016. This is just devastating, and it just shows the enormous challenge we're facing from this rogue state, from the state that is constantly threatening to attack the United States and its neighboring allies with nuclear weapons and with missiles. I think there's real questions as to the sophistication of these weapons, and I tend to side, from my time with the CIA, I tend to side with experts who believe that their technology is not nearly as far advanced as some experts think. But I got to tell you, given the rapid advances in their missile program and the fact that the yields of their nuclear tests have had five nuclear tests since 2006, they've gotten substantially greater. I don't think we can rule out the possibility that there have been some very significant advances in North Korea's nuclear program. They claim they have miniaturized warheads that can fit within missiles that could be fired at least at regional states, possibly in an ICBM. Now, will their ICBMs have a guidance system accurate enough to hit the United States? Do they have a reentry vehicle so the ICBM would not be destroyed by the extreme heat and pressure reentering the atmosphere? No one knows that. But I believe China is beginning to wake up to the reality that, as I said earlier, this program is on a very dangerous trajectory. And although I think for a while North Korea's antics served China's interests because it was basically threatening the United States and occupying our time, I think China's realizing that North Korea is becoming a major regional threat. And China is concerned what the United States may do. Now, we would like to put the THAAD anti-missile defense system in South Korea. Unfortunately, the new South Korean president, Moon, stopped that. This was actually approved by the last administration. Unfortunately, it was never deployed. We were rushing in May of this year to deploy the system before Moon took office. But unfortunately, it wasn't fully deployed. And one of the first things he did when he came to office was to order the system not be deployed. I'm hopeful that our diplomats and President Trump can convince President Moon to change his mind, because this sends a message not just to North Korea. It sends a message to China. China does not want the system deployed. They believe it is a threat to their security. So hopefully this is something that we'll be able to do. I think we also have to redeploy nuclear weapons in South Korea. This is something, these weapons were removed by the first Bush administration as a gesture to bring about some type of nuclear agreement with North Korea. That agreement was struck during the Clinton administration. The North Koreans violated it. I think it's time that we do that. That also will send a message to China and to North Korea. In addition, I think we have to consider some other pretty stern steps, such as a very strong set of financial sanctions and cutting off links to international banking institutions by North Korea. We'll do this outside of the UN. We can't let the Chinese veto steps that have to be taken. We also may have to start shooting down North Korean missiles, basically because we can't allow these to be developed any further. I'm cautiously optimistic, very cautious, that the Chinese may be moving to helping us. But I'm worried because their track record is just so awful. But let's hope that this decision by China to join this latest set of sanctions mean that they've finally woken up to the regional threat that North Korea poses and will join us in putting intense pressure to stop this program. My name is Fred Flights. I'm substituting for Frank Affney on Secure Freedom Radio. My first guest today will be Joe Jigenova, who will discuss Robert Mueller and his special counsel investigation of the Trump administration. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Fred Flight substituting for your usual host, Frank Gaffney, who is on a well-earned vacation. My first guest today is attorney Joe Jigenova. He is founding partner of the Washington, D.C. law firm of Jigenova & Tenzing, a former U.S. attorney with the District of Columbia, a former chief counsel and staff director of the Senate Rules Committee, and former chief counsel of the Senate Judiciary, Government Affairs, and Select Intelligence Committees. Joe, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, Fred.
Well, we have some serious matters to discuss today concerning Robert Mueller, the special counsel investigating, I think, Russian interference in the election and other related matters. I wanted to start by asking you about a recent report that Mueller is seeking White House documents on former National Security Advisor Flynn, and that he may have questioned witnesses of whether Flynn was secretly paid by the Turkish government during the final months of the presidential campaign. What is your take on this?
Well, it sounds like that investigation stems from these various forms that General Flynn was required to file when he became, during the transition team, an advisor to the incoming president, and indeed after the inauguration forms. And apparently he did not reveal certain things concerning dealings with both the Russians in the form of compensation for actions taken, but also in the form of compensation taken from Turkey and Turkish representatives. So that appears to be, if we can believe what we've read in the press about it, a relatively normal, understandable investigation of potential failure to disclose on appropriate federal forms.
But does this investigation sort of you confirm the criticism of what Mueller is doing, that his mandate seems to allow him to go anywhere? He's not just looking at alleged Russian interference in the election.
Well, that grand jury actually started before Mueller was appointed over in the Eastern District of Virginia. But I assume he has taken control of it because it is directly related to the or appears to be related to the Russian influence. If it isn't, it shouldn't be his. But we've never been told whether or not that is his investigation. So it could be that it remains with Maine Justice, but I doubt that because it's too close to the incoming administration. So it's probably his investigation that he has taken over. With regard to the other investigations of any theoretical possibility that the Russian government or Russian representatives attempted to influence our election somehow illegally, whatever that would be, and there's no evidence that they did, that is a separate investigation, which now has begun in a separate grand jury in the District of Columbia. And the fact that Mueller opened up a new grand jury in the District of Columbia instead of using the one already in existence in the Eastern District of Virginia is a very bad sign. And there's a reason for that. The District of Columbia is unfriendly to Republicans in terms of juries and grand juries. It is a known fact from the Scooter Libby case that not only the jurors in that case didn't like Scooter Libby, but they didn't like his bosses, Bush and Cheney. And after the Scooter Libby verdict of guilty on lying to the federal prosecutors in the grand jury, an outrageous case, by the way, that never should have been brought, the jurors who sat in the case were interviewed, and they wanted to know why Bush and Cheney hadn't been indicted. It sounded as if there was a phenomenal amount of prejudice against the Republican administration, and subsequent research has shown that that is exactly the case.
Yeah, Alan Dershowitz recently said this in a op-ed in The Hill, that there was no need for, he can't conceive of why there was a second grand jury. The jury that's already convened in Alexandria, Virginia, is easily accessible to the prosecutor's team. Have they given a reason why he needed a second grand jury?
No, they have not. But I can assure you that the only reason he would have done that was to bringing a case in the District of Columbia where there is an inherent prejudice in the jury pool against Republicans, as outrageously evidenced by the juror comments in the Scooter Libby case. So there's no reason he couldn't have used the grand jury in Virginia except to gain a tactical, if not a strategic advantage against anybody in the District of Columbia, because then he has leverage. He said, look, I can indict this case here. Why don't you do a guilty plea with me? We'll work out a deal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Andy McCarthy, who I know you know well, wrote a very compelling op-ed in National Review on August 5th entitled Robert Mueller's Grand Jury Impeachment Step One. And he mentions that the standard of high crimes and misdemeanors, which is needed for impeachment, is a sort of a vague concept that easily could be manipulated in a grand jury report to form the foundation of a case for impeachment. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's no doubt about it that a grand jury can be used for those purposes. Of course, Ken Starr's grand jury investigation in the Monica Lewinsky and Whitewater matter led to the issuance of a special report to the House of Representatives, which in fact did lead to the impeachment of Bill Clinton, who was subsequently acquitted in the United States Senate. So Andy McCarthy, as usual, is right on the money. And I don't know if that's Mueller's goal, but I take a view of this that I don't know what Mueller's up to. He's always seemed to be a smart, very savvy guy, a little bit too judgmental about people, just like his dear friend Jim Comey. Comey used to tell people famously when he was deputy attorney general, if you disagreed with him on a major issue, that your moral compass was askew. This was his standard reply to people with whom he disagreed. I've never heard stories like that about Bob Mueller, but Mueller was a kind of pretty tightly wound guy who didn't like things going out of order. I don't know what his game is here. I think the president is in some jeopardy at this point, given the wide berth that Mueller has been given by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. I do not know why there were no limitations in his appointment letter. So I think that Andy's concern is well placed. I will say this. I think if the president gets into a position where he thinks a family member of his is in serious jeopardy, he's either going to pardon that family member or he's going to fire Mueller. It'll never get to the point where Mueller is able to bring indictments. And all these idiotic bills up on Capitol Hill by Republicans and Democrats who are trying to limit the power of the president, fire the special counsel, all of those bills are unconstitutional. The president can fire anybody he wants in the executive branch. He is the executive branch.
Well, Andy writes that a grand jury could file a no true bill finding that the prosecutor failed to show probable cause that the subject of the investigation committed a crime. But with two grand juries, that increases the chance that Mueller will be able to get a report that would be very damaging to this president.
Well, he's going to have to get special permission from either the Fourth Circuit or the D.C. Circuit to issue a report. You're only allowed to issue reports in matters involving organized crime. The reason Ken Starr was able to issue a report was because that was part of the old independent counsel statute, which gave the independent counsel the authority to issue a report. That authority does not exist for a normal criminal investigation, which is what this is. Even though he's a so-called special counsel, he was appointed by the Department of Justice, and he's an employee of the Department of Justice. And the only kind of grand jury reports that are available are reports about organized crime activity. There's a very special statute that deals with that, and they're called special grand juries. This is not one of those grand juries. So I'm not sure that Andy's right on that. And I don't know that Mueller would be given permission to issue such a report to Congress or anybody else.
Well, Joe Jigenova, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your incisive analysis of this important issue. This is Fred Flight substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. Next up, General Jerry Boykin. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Fred Flight substituting for Frank Gaffney. My next guest will be General Jerry Boykin. He is the Executive Vice President of the Family Research Council. Jerry served as Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, and he is an original member of the U.S. Army's Delta Force. General Boykin, welcome.
Hey, Fred. Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
I wanted to talk to you about President Trump's statement that he is banning transgenders from serving in the military, and I wanted to first by reading a tweet that you sent out on this. The tweet read, "To say that I am pleased to see President Trump put a stop to this transgender madness in the military would be an understatement." And you also wrote, "It would be another indicator to me that our president is truly focused on military readiness." Could you expound on this, General?
Yeah, look, I think that the average citizen, certainly those who are polled, only 23% of them believe that we ought to have openly transgender service members serving. So the majority of Americans see this for what it is. It's insanity. Every decision that is made by our Congress and by our president regarding our military should be made with the question up front of how does this enhance the readiness of our military? How does it make us more capable of winning the nation's wars? Remember, that's what Douglas MacArthur told the students at West Point in 1963 when he said, "Your mission remains fixed, constant, inviolable. It's to win the nation's wars." And that is where we need to be focused today. So how does adding transgenders to our military service enhance readiness? And the answer is it doesn't. In fact, it detracts from readiness because of all the time away from their job. So I think Trump is looking at this from a very common sense perspective, and I am glad to see that he's really focused on bringing back our warfighter focus and a focus on winning the wars.
General Boykin, let's talk about the general issue of military readiness. What is the state of our military readiness right now?
Well, I think as we transition from the Obama administration to the Trump administration, it was abysmal. I think that budget cuts, program budget cuts, plus sequestration certainly set us back. And I think you've probably heard that our Army was the smallest since World War II, since pre-World War II. That our Navy was the same, and that in both the Navy and the Marine Corps that we're actually cannibalizing airplanes and in some cases taking parts from airplanes in museums and displays to keep our fleet flying. That is a sad state of readiness for a nation as powerful and as I guess, productive as the United States. So our military readiness was in sad shape. But I think that the two things, in addition to the budget cuts that have been very problematic, is one is the assault on religious liberty in our military. And number two is the social experiments. And all these social experiments bring with them a training package that is not just a one-time thing, it's a routine thing. And you talk particularly to a National Guard or reserve component soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine, and they will tell you that they sometimes spend an entire weekend in a classroom listening to lectures on these social experiments. That is a gross and unforgivable waste of training time when they should be preparing for war.
Yeah, I remember when the Clinton administration tried to do that when I was at the CIA, but they actually were unsuccessful. I think the Obama administration took this a lot further. Now, talk about the costs of special compensation and services that this transgender initiative may have inflicted on the military?
Yeah, we did a survey, and just based on the military's own statistics of how many people would be impacted by this, we did a very detailed cost analysis on this. In over a decade, we believe that this whole program would cost between about $1.9 billion to about $3.7 or $8 billion. And that includes a loss of training of time. In other words, paying someone pay and benefits while they are in a non-deployable status, which is exactly what you will have when, as people go through the therapy for, you know, the hormone therapy as well as the transgender surgery. You're going to have people that are not deployable, people that will just basically be doing nothing but making this transition. We have to pay those people full pay and allowances during that period of time. And then when you look at the cost of the therapy and the surgery itself and all, it's a staggering figure. And, you know, if you went to the high end of that, we discovered that you could buy 22 F-35 fighters for what it would cost us for this transgender program. At the top end of it, and really about 166 Chinook helicopters. So it's insanity as far as I am concerned. It has nothing to do with winning wars.
Well, General Jerry Boykin, I want to turn to a very different issue, and that concerns the threat from North Korea. In response to UN sanctions imposed on North Korea last weekend, the North Korean government has vowed to make the U.S. pay dearly. There also has been satellite coverage, supposedly, of cruise missiles being placed on small North Korean ships. How do you read this North Korean response to these new sanctions?
Yeah, Fred, you know, you and I have we've discussed this a number of times, and you know, individually and in group settings. I think that while everybody understands that Kim Jong-un is certifiably crazy, he's not as irrational as people think. I think that he's saving face with this kind of thing, but I think it's a very tense and a very dangerous situation. But I do not believe that he wants to provoke the United States or South Korea into a war because he loses. And I think he's rational enough to know that he loses. And that doesn't mean he's not going to continue testing his missiles and even his warheads. And again, I think it's a very dangerous situation, but I think he knows he loses. He cannot win. He's going to lose his country and probably be killed in the process if he provokes America into a war. And Donald Trump is unpredictable, I think, in his mind, as well as the minds of, you know, world leaders all over.
I'm sort of wondering your views on China. China has been heavily criticizing for not adhering to prior Security Council resolutions. What are the chances that they will abide by these new sanctions?
Well, the track record is certainly not good, as you just said. And China, remember, China helped North Korea get to where they are today. And I think that, quite frankly, I think China is realizing also that they don't have the influence. That all the materiel and the money and the trade and everything over the years has not bought them the influence that I think they wanted with North Korea. I think they'd like for this North Korea situation to go away, but at the same time, I'm not sure that they have any good options. Since Kim Jong-nam was killed, who really was the guy that they were kind of holding in Macau, China, to be put in as a replacement for Kim Jong-un, and once he was killed there in Kuala Lumpur, I think that China was sort of back to square one in terms of, okay, what if we do find a way to get rid of this guy? Who do we replace him with? And I don't think they have a good answer to that right now. So, you know, the best thing that could happen, Fred, is for some of his own people to go just kill him, just take him out. But I don't see that materializing right now. Maybe you know something I don't.
Well, General Boykin, I have to wrap it up there. You've been listening to Executive Vice President of the Family Research Council, General Jerry Boykin. Thank you so much for your comments. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney. Next up, I'll be speaking to economist Kevin Freeman on what he believes is a coming trade war. Stay tuned.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. My name is Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. My next guest is Kevin Freeman. He is author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, another very well-regarded book, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and How It Can Happen Again. He is founder of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com. He is a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, and he will be host of Economic War Room, which will be debuting on The Blaze in the summer of 2017. Kevin Freeman, welcome.
Thank you, Fred. Great to be here.
Now, Kevin, you have a very interesting blog you posted today on a coming trade war with the United States. I'd like you to first tell our audience where they can find this piece and go over your major judgments.
Sure. It's found at globaleconomicwarfare.com, which is my blog. The title is Don't Worry About a Coming Trade War, We're Already in One. And basically, recently, the political intelligentsia has been accusing President Trump of pushing us towards a trade war. And the Russians have picked up on that theme, and when we applied sanctions, they said, oh, you're creating a trade war. But the bottom line is we've been in a trade war, and President Trump is just recognizing it and responding to it.
Now, something I saw you wrote in this piece is basically there is a globalist free trade crowd that wants American policy to always revert to free trade. What did you mean by that?
Well, there are the globalists that run multinational corporations, that run a lot of the think tanks and so forth, that just make a couple of assumptions. They assume that the Cold War is over, therefore everybody is just playing for money, and the money they're playing for is dollars. And so really all we have to do is compete economically, and we should have free trade as much as possible under all circumstances. Well, if you follow that line of thinking, then you end up selling sensitive technology to potential adversaries and enemies. And so they're arguing, well, we should just a free exchange of everything, because they just ignore the national security aspects of it. What we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space, and they're competing against us to win for their nation's interests, and we're sitting here thinking, well, we're all citizens of the world.
You also write that these free trade globalists reconcile their position by assuming that the United States or the West will always be the leader of the global order. But you're saying that that may not always be the case, or there's something else going on?
Well, we want to assume that America will always be the world's leader, that everybody will always be using the U.S. dollar, that our Western financial system will always be the main means of exchange between nations. Well, China has been, for 5 years at least, been working to make sure that that's not so. 5 years ago, they said that we've got to de-Americanize the world. We've got to remove the American control of the financial system. The Russians have been rapidly moving that direction. And of course, the Iranians, the North Koreans, they would like to see us wiped off the map entirely. So we have a false assumption that America is permanent, much the same as the British had an assumption that the sun never sets on the British Empire.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. My guest is economist Kevin Freeman. Kevin, let's talk about the issue of economic theft by China, especially IP theft, and how should President Trump address this?
Well, that's a perfect example. We think that we're competing fairly and playing a fair board game while they're cheating the entire time. And so, you know, Fred, you actually pulled together a phenomenal book, Warning Order, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. And in that, I was privileged to write a chapter. They're stealing billions of dollars of intellectual property every year. They're stealing it through cyber means. They're stealing it through having companies come in and operate in China with the promise of access to the Chinese market, and then they steal the technology and secrets. And they're controlling it, just like they've recently told Apple, oh, you can sell iPhones here, but in your app store, you have to remove these apps so that people can't access the international web without our filtering and control. So they've been playing a very purposed game for national dominance from their perspective, and we've just been assuming everybody's playing by the fair rules.
Well, I want to turn to a related issue, and that is a report that Iran recently reached a deal with the French automaker Renault, despite U.S. sanctions, with Iran, a $780 million deal to produce 150,000 cars. And I didn't understand from the piece, would these be produced in Iran or not? But could you comment on this story and how it relates to your overall concerns about a trade war?
Well, just as an example, Renault is an automaker who said, we don't care what your sanctions are. We don't care what the Iranians are doing or that you have legitimate reasons in the international community to apply sanctions. We want to do business here because it's just money. It's just business. I mean, this is the same thing that came up 5 years ago when we caught the British and American banks essentially laundering money for the Iranian regime against sanctions. A Standard Chartered, a huge bank in the United Kingdom, had internal emails who said, you effing Americans, who are you to tell us who we can do business with? And you know, what it says is that those of us on the West, in the West, view this as a marketplace. It's just an opportunity to make money. I guarantee that the Iranian purpose is not just to acquire cars. They're doing much that they can do to build their missile program, to develop their nuclear program, to do all sorts of things. And there's technology that they're wanting here that they're going to acquire, just like the Chinese acquire technology every time we build something in China. So this is a battle space for them, but we naively view it as a marketplace.
And I imagine deals like this are also intended by Tehran to make it much harder to convince European states to abrogate the 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran.
Oh, absolutely. What they're doing is, we're just good citizens of the world just like everybody else, while behind the scenes they continue to violate every agreement that they've had. They continue to develop nuclear weapons. They continue to shout death to America. This is a perfect example. We in the West view it as a marketplace. Our enemies see this as a battle space for the war of ideas so that they can win hearts and minds of politicians, or whether it is to steal technology.
And finally, I want to talk about the recent U.S. sanctions on Russia. The fact that the Russians are expelling 755 U.S. diplomats has gotten a lot of play in the press. But there also are concerns that the Russians believe that this will result in a full-blown trade war between the United States and Russia. What's your take on this?
My take is they're just threatening that. That we've got to do what we've got to do. We're already in a trade war, and the Russians are using that language because they know that they can appeal to the economics crowd in the United States and separate them from national security interests. And they're masters at this game. They've been playing it for a long time. The old Soviet Union used to do this. We would have oil interests there, and they would exploit our interest in their energy in the ground, whether it was through Armand Hammer or others, and then they would use that to influence administrations and influence politically. Russians don't just hack elections or hack DNC or whatever. They use every means at their disposal to achieve their objectives. They see this as a battle space.
It seems to me that the Russians have a lot more to lose by a trade war with the United States than we do. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. We're the only way that we can lose in a trade war with Russia is if we don't know we're in one. if they continue to take advantage, or if they use it, as I'm suggesting they're doing here, to manipulate the U.S. politicians and electorate. So, oh, President Trump is bad. President Trump's going to get us in a trade war. That meme is already out there, and they're just applying it here to try and make what he's doing that's good and right in terms of sanctions to look like it's a bad decision. They're just trying to make the president look bad using that. But in a real trade war, they'd get wiped.
Well, Kevin Freeman, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you for joining me today. You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney. Thank you for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.